everything.
Okay, everyone, welcome today to this episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, joined as always by the ever lovely, ever talented, ever intelligent Mr. Mike Tremont. Mike, how are you doing today?
Good, and I'm here too. That guy you were just describing, I don't know where he is, but I am here and I'm with you and happy to be so. Thanks.
Because as we promised for I think 2 weeks running, we're going to talk about stuff that's happening now, but that also appeals to a certain segment of nerds. So we could definitely figure this out and get it done in a way.
I think we should be thankful that virtually everything we talk about appeals to nerds. I don't know if that's the good
nerds
news or the bad news.
Jocks, Mike. You have to keep that in mind. Nerds are the new jocks. So, you know, our time has finally come. We've only been waiting 50 years since high school.
All right. Then let's hit the weight room.
So the thing we're going to talk about today is the Federal Reserve. You always hear, especially those of a libertarian bent, and the Fed. So, for the average American, Mike, give me the high 10,000-foot overview. What is the Federal Reserve, and why do you and I hate it so much?
Oh, my goodness. The Federal Reserve System is a system of reserve banks, which is to say banks that operate pursuant to charters from the federal government. They have leadership in Washington at the Federal Reserve Board, which is a bunch of largely professional economists and a couple of bankers who are appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. And the Federal Reserve Board provides supervision to these regional reserve banks, which were set up to accept reserves from commercial banks. So commercial banks were required to keep reserves on account with the federal government at these Federal Reserve banks so that they would always be able to meet certain reserve requirements in order to control how much money was being lent out. It was a way to either slow down or speed up the rate at which banks would take deposits and then make loans. So as you might imagine, if the federal government were to say your reserve requirement were 100% of the deposits you were taking in, you wouldn't be able to lend any money at all, right? You would take in your deposit, and the federal government would say, well, you have to have 100% of that on reserve with your regional reserve bank. You wouldn't be able to lend any money out. And that's just an exaggerated example. The reserve requirements were historically set at something like 5%, and then lower, much lower. And the Federal Reserve banks would follow these rules. The commercial banks would follow these rules. And then a robust market was created among the commercial banks to trade these reserves held with the reserve banks. So a bank would have to meet its requirements on a daily basis that might change every day, right? Because your deposits would change every day. So the amount of money that you had to keep at the Federal Reserve Bank in your district, in your locality, if you were a California bank, you'd have to keep money on reserve with the San Francisco Federal Reserve Bank. And every day you would have to monitor, do I have enough money there or do I not? Depending on what the federal government's rules were at the moment, depending on how big your deposits were at the moment. And so banks would find themselves, I got a few hours to go. I got to get some more money and put it on reserve. And so the banks started trading among themselves these reserves.
Try to maintain, at least on paper, what the Federal Reserve said you should have. And as a practical matter, lack of sufficient reserves is what resulted on runs on banks. So all those old photos you had during the Depression of people lining up to say, I want my money from the bank, and the bank would say, There's none here. We loaned it all out, or, you know. So, and the other key phrase people may have heard, Mike, is fractional reserves.
In other words, you don't have to keep all of the deposits on reserve. It's virtually impossible to imagine more than you know, 5% of your depositors demanding their money back at any particular point in time. And so you had to just keep a fraction of your deposits on reserve. And so this market developed where banks would trade among themselves the reserves that they had in holdings at the Federal Reserve Bank. And the Federal Reserve Banks would therefore help facilitate the creation of this market and ultimately would affect this market by playing a role in it themselves, trading with the banks, setting the interest rate target that they wanted these reserves to be traded. And that is how the Federal Reserve system of controlling monetary policy came to be, is that the Federal Reserve system would control, by participating in these markets, they were the huge player in these markets, they would control how many reserves were available, and therefore they would control the interest rate at which these reserves were available, and that meant controlling the speed with which and the extent to which commercial banks could lend out the deposits that they had. And that would control the extent to which money was available in our economy. And that's how the Fed has traditionally, up until recently, these days, it works a little bit differently, but that's beside the point, frankly. But until very recently, this is how the Fed would control how commercial banks would either juice up our economy or tamp down our economy, depending on whether reserve requirements were being increased or decreased.
Right. So this is how we always say the economy is controlled by the Fed, right? Like if you want the economy to heat up, you lower interest rates. If you want to put the brakes on the economy, you increase the rates. Fair enough. That's the overview. There's various mechanisms, right? But that's the overview. But now, someone sitting in the heartland right now might say, well, why are these dopey libertarians always complaining about the Fed? Isn't that a good thing that we have the Fed to either lower interest rates and get this economy raging like President Trump wants? Or, you know, why in the world would anyone ever raise rates? Why would anyone ever increase rates for people and slow down the economy? But isn't this a good thing that we have somebody controlling this, Mike?
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. There are arguments to be made that it was a good idea, that it was just an idea that was so difficult on which to execute that it turned out to be virtually impossible. The other argument against it, we'll unpack that. The other argument is that the Fed it's an impossible task, and the Fed has failed on it because they were just set up for failure. So starting with whether or not it works, which, you know, let's set the philosophy aside for a moment. And let's just talk about it, you know, as a practical matter. The Fed has allowed reserve requirements to become so small, has allowed banks to operate in a sufficiently freewheeling fashion that so much money gets created that it causes inflation. And the Fed's major task is to control the value of the money supply, which is to say, not allow so much money to be created that the value of the money becomes diminished over time, which is, of course, what we call inflation. So the Fed's job is to prevent that. The Fed has taken upon itself in recent decades to target a 2% inflation rate. A lot of us have a problem with that for a couple of different reasons. Just sort of philosophically, it seems like you should be targeting a 0% inflation rate. I think that is still not only philosophically a good idea, but as a practical matter, I think that's a good idea. The Fed argues that you need a little bit of inflation to make to lube the economy, to make things work better. It helps corporations and contracts to see a little bit of demand pressure artificially created by some inflation. You know, imagine you're a corporation, you see prices going up. It's very hard to tease out whether your expectations should be, well, that's not really meaningful. It's just the Fed pumping more money into the economy. And therefore I'm going to disregard it because I know my costs are about to come up as well. Or does it really mean, gee, my product is so wonderful, people are just banging down the door and trying to get it, and therefore I need to produce more of this, which is how the economy
right.
gets
and,
juiced.
And I think that's a very subtle point that a lot of people miss, and I think the way you stated it is good. Businesses don't know where these pricing pressures come from when you have a Fed. When you leave it to markets to decide, the prices, in actuality, are signals, right? This is when you hear free market economists say prices are signals. That's all they are. So to the extent that if you see prices start to rise in a free market, it means there's demand for a product. And if you see prices decline, it means, hey, things have leveled out or are bottoming out.
Less demand, that's right.
People can adjust. Businesses can adjust. People, consumers can adjust. Whereas now, as you said, is it because the Fed is pumping a couple of $1 trillion into the economy? Is it because they're artificially lowering or raising rates? So I think
it's very hard to tease right. that out. It has often been said correctly that the Fed is in the business of tricking the production side of the economy into producing more than it otherwise would by creating some inflation and allowing people to believe that that's just increased demand, and so you better start producing more. Of course, where that goes awry is that people learn to expect a certain amount of inflation, to anticipate that that's going to come on their cost side as well as on their revenue side, and therefore they don't produce more. And as you say, they're left with trying to tease out whether their price increase is an action of the Fed or an action of supply and demand. The other reason that a 2% is targeted by the Fed is sort of a political construct. The Fed believes that by targeting something that's not zero, it relieves some of the political pressure that would otherwise be on it. Whether that's true or not in this day and age is a bit of a complex matter, but that is something that has been believed for a long time, that by targeting something other than zero, it gives the Fed a little bit of wriggle room. Now, having said that, that's also a problem. First of all, the 2%, let's start with the 2% instead of the zero. That's a problem because it's always diminishing the value of your money, so you best not hold it, right? Anyone holding money is losing 2% a year all the time. Well, you're losing not just the 2% target. If the Fed is inflating prices at the rate of 3% a year, whether the target was 2 or not, you're losing 3. So nobody likes the idea of, you know, every year you lose 3% of the value of your holdings denominated in dollars. That's a problem, which is why we say, you know, you need to hedge against the destruction of the value of your currency, which is one of the reasons why people invest in the stock market, because the stock market will artificially blow up when the value of the dollar diminishes
and that,
as well.
That's when you okay. hear, like, just to jump in, Mike, that's when you hear stock market commentators on CNBC or whatever say the market has baked in an interest rate cut, like whether it's a quarter point or whatever.
They already expect it.
Markets move. But that works in the opposite end, that if you don't get the expected rate cut,
they get disappointed, and the whatever gain there had been will get reversed. Of course, we absolutely see that. The other problem with targeting something other than zero, besides the diminution of the value of the money itself, per se, which of course is a problem, is that the Fed constantly misses the target. And when it misses the target, it doesn't seem like as big a deal. And that's a problem. We want it to seem like a big deal. In other words, if you were targeting zero, and once in a while you hit a negative 0.4, once in a while you hit a positive 0.4, you know, we would be able to grump about that, and we would all understand that it's supposed to be zero. But we live under a regime in which they target 2. And when they hit 2.7, we act like that was pretty good. No! That's not pretty good. I'm not saying it's awful. I'm not saying that they're idiots. I'm not saying they tried to miss. I'm just saying 2.7 ain't a 2. There is a difference.
See, and this is where I think, like, nerds like us thrive on this, and then, like, most people are like, what's 0.7? 0.7 is 30% of 2. Think about it that way. It's a third. It's a third of 2.
Yeah, you missed it by a considerable amount, and that becomes even more important when it's 3.5. Well, 3.5 isn't all that big a deal. It's only 0.8 more than 2.7. No! It's 3.8 is 3.8 more than zero.
Right. And the practical effect, because let's tie this back to people's everyday lives. Like, when you say you're targeting 2% inflation, using the law of 72, right? That's every 36 years, prices will double.
Which means the value of your money is going to get cut in half if you're right. You're holding
right.
It. That's right.
And that's at 2%. Like you said, if it hits 3, 4, 5%, that accelerates, right?
It's getting cut in half. At 4%, it's getting cut in half in 18 years. That's
exactly.
A real problem.
So that's the practical effect.
That's a big deal.
Which, if you think on a practical level, for all the people that, much like Mike and myself, have a couple of gray hairs, living on a fixed income, that's a really big deal because your dollar buys less for you. You can't afford your groceries as easy. Can't afford to go get your health care or whatever. So the practical effect of the Fed's machinations is people can't afford stuff. The value of your dollar goes down. And the fact that it's based on paper and not gold or silver or diamonds or some hard asset,
means the Fed can just create as much money as it wants willy-nilly, and that causes as much inflation as the Fed wants willy-nilly, and that's a problem for you, both in terms of the signaling effect that you were talking about earlier. You can't tell what's going on in terms of making the investment decisions and production decisions, and for anyone holding dollars, it's going to devalue your wealth.
Like the third leg of this that I know you're just itching to get to, is the political leg of this, right? So we have the economic, the very practical effects, the theoretical effects of having a Fed play around with rates and scarcity and things of that nature. But then there's the political leg. And we're seeing that play out now, right? The political leg of it is getting the Fed to manipulate rates to achieve political goals, right? Whatever they may be.
Yep.
I'm not saying conservative, liberal, but and that's why, as you've often said, having a Fed is bad, but at least having an independent Fed, or at least a largely independent Fed, is better than having a politicized Fed, one that works hand-in-hand with the, especially the Oval Office, right?
Right. And let's be clear, the reason I personally have a problem with the Fed is because I don't think that the Fed, notwithstanding employing a lot of smart and a lot of wonderful and a lot of patriotic and hardworking people, this isn't personal, all right? Everyone settle down. We're not trying to, you know, mean up on anybody. We've all known, I personally have known literally hundreds of Fed economists.
You're an Austrian economist,
and
so what you say comes from that perspective. So
it does, but I have met so many really wonderful, hardworking people that are trying to make this work. So what I mean to say is, despite that, the system doesn't work very well over time. The Fed has not managed to control inflation the way that we wish it would. The Fed has not diminished the cyclicality of the boom-bust cycle.
It's just getting wider, right? Peak to trough. It's getting bigger, I think, as we progress, right?
Well, 2008 was certainly an example of a big drop, and that was because of a lot of regulatory crap that the Fed was also involved in. That is a whole other conversation. The COVID crash was huge, again because of other reasons. The Fed had a major role in the Great Depression in the leading from 1929 through the 30s. The Fed has gotten much smarter since then. But having said all of that and given them all kinds of excuses, it is still the case that we believe that the most assiduous research would demonstrate that we would be better off with a set of rules rather than the way that the Fed sets policy today. The way the Fed decides what interest rates should be, how much money should be created in the economy, is quite literally, we get a dozen people in a room every 6 weeks, every 42 days, and we ask them what should the interest rate go up or should it go down and by how much. And that's, I don't think most Americans realize that. I think it's a very goofy system, and it's a system that has proved over time not to be very good. Now, it depends on your yardstick, right? Relative to other countries, it works very well. It works very well. Other countries have found ways to do this even worse than we do. And what's going on in our politics today is suggestive of a movement to go toward what other countries do. So as much as we are frustrated with the imperfections in the Fed system, I wish it were a rules-based system and not up to people's, economists' moods, even if these are, 12 of the smartest people in the world. They're just so wonderful. But, it's just not a very good system. It should be a rules-based system.
And it does sound almost, and oversimplifying for effect, but it is like tea leaf reading, right? Like you've got these dozen or so governors, they come in and they say, oh, let's look at these tea leaves. Is inflation creeping up, down? Do we need to juice the economy? Not juicy, right? Now, of course, it's much more sophisticated. They have all sorts of charts and numbers to back up their assertions, right? But what you're suggesting is, it is sort of like an umpire in baseball. Leave as little to his discretion as possible. You want rules. So, like, if the money supply, and there's different M's, if you're M1, M2, all that stuff, that's what they're talking about. If it increases by a fixed percentage of output, then you throttle back, then you throttle ahead, right? So you're saying, like, take as much discretion as possible out of it. If we have to have a Fed, no more people sitting around smoking cigars. Now, I think it should go up a basis point or two. None of that. You're saying it's a
none of that.
You're saying you plug numbers in.
You do it off of a spreadsheet, and this would give markets the chance to understand that any changes in inflation were not because of changes in Fed policy, because Fed policy would be locked in, but rather it would be a matter of changes in supply and demand, and that's what you want for these signals to be readable. So, the rule I would suggest is that the money supply is allowed to be increased by a certain percentage each year, say 2%. But what really matters is that you have a rule. That's much more important than whether or not, you agree that it ought to be 1% or 2% or 3%. What really matters is that there is a rule. And your baseball analogy is pretty good. The major leagues are experimenting now with these electronically read strike zone, electronically read strike zone. We all know, anyone who's played baseball in America knows, you spend the first three innings figuring out where the strike zone is. Yeah. Is the umpire going to give the pitcher, at the knees or below? Right. Is it at the eyes? Is it at the nose? The tall guy crouching down, the short guy crouching down, the tall guy standing up. Where is the umpire going to be on this? And it's part of the game. It's part of the sport. It's all fun and good. But if it's your money and your economy, those first three innings are not something that you should have
right,
to go through.
Time. And it's time that impacts productivity. So the other thing that a rules-based system would provide is sort of like an apolitical Fed, right? Because there wouldn't be pressures from both sides politically to say, do this, do that. My domestic agenda, my foreign policy agenda, like all that would not play into anything. And the reason it's particularly relevant now is, notice the great segue, is we're getting right into President Trump, all sorts of attacks, both personal and professional, on the Fed chief, Jerome Powell, the man he appointed in 2019, I think, or no, 2017 he appointed, right?
Yeah. Something like that. His term is almost ended.
President Trump, the first go-round. he was reappointed by President Biden when his first term was up. So he's been bilaterally appointed, right? You can't blame it like this is a Trump thing, this is a Biden thing. Both presidents appointed this guy. Right now, President Trump seems to be upset that Powell is not cutting rates. He says, hey, it's been proven my tariffs are not bad for inflation. Go, go, go. Let's get this economy booming. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Powell is saying, well, hold on. The president has threatened to fire Powell before his term ends. He pulled back from that based on market reactions a week ago, Mike. I think actually as we were taping last week's episode, like literally
the market was crashing while we were doing our show.
Trump kind of pulled back from firing Powell.
It was coming back already.
So you can see the effect this even messing the notion of messing with the Fed has on markets, right? So talk to me about this, Mike. Talk to me first about Powell. Give me an indication. How do you view Jerome Powell's job at the Fed? I mean, the job he's done at the Fed.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that he's like almost any other Fed chair, which is to say he's doing as good a job as, you know, some economists could do. There's nothing about Jerome Powell that suggests that he's either, you know, a heck of a lot smarter than all the other economists in the world, or that he's a lot dumber than all the other economists in the world. He's a very smart guy. He's very earnest. He's very committed. He understands how the Fed works. He understands monetary policy. He's steeped in this stuff. If you're going to pick a human, and again, I wish this were a laptop instead of a human, but if you're going to pick a human, he's fine.
Okay.
You know, he's as good as humans are going to be in this role. You're not going to be able to replace him with someone else. And all of a sudden, the system is going to work much better. What it is that the administration wants is the same thing as every American administration has ever wanted, and is the same thing as every executive branch, every president, every prime minister, and every king has ever wanted at any government, at any point in time, at any place on this particular planet. And that is, they all want more money. They want more money to be created so that their economy runs faster because they don't anticipate the inflation or because they think that the inflation will happen after they're out of office.
More likely, Mike, yep.
That's probably more like it. So that so that they can spend more money from the government and issue bonds and have those bonds purchased by either the central bank directly, by the Federal Reserve directly, which happens all the time, or will be purchased by financial institutions who are flushed with cash by virtue of the Fed having created all this money in the world. And so either way, whether it's because you want the economy to run harder or because you want to spend a great deal of money directly out of the federal government of the United States, this is what presidents always want. In that sense, when Trump says he wants rates to be lower and he thinks that Jerome is too late and he thinks the Fed has been too late and he wants more money and more inflation to be created, it's very, very been there, done that, this is not, you know, like you think that you came up with it. Every president asks for this. The answer, therefore, has to always be no. Central banks around the world who have said okay have seen their currencies undermined in value, which is why so many currencies around the world are crappy compared to ours, right? Nobody wants to be caught holding rubles.
Right.
Why would you want to hold rubles when you know that the value of the ruble is going to diminish by Friday because Putin wants to create more money? It's just, you know, that is not a thing that any investor who is rational would be caught dead or alive doing. And so we recognize from experiences all over the world that the ultimate in bad policy is not just when a president or a prime minister minister or a king or a dick beats the crap out of his or her central bank until the central bank does his or her bidding. That's bad enough. The ultimate in bad behavior is when the government just takes over the central bank or never had an independent central bank in the first place. In other words, there are plenty of governments around the world where the Treasury issues the money and controls the money supply and decides on bank regulation and decides whether there are reserve requirements and just goes rampant, right? Just does whatever that they want to do in their currency worth crap. And that happens fairly quickly when money is politicized,
right,
which is what we're trying to avoid.
And I think that's an important key, right? Because to the extent that the Fed has messed up our own currency, right, that the value of the dollar today going back, not forget 1913 when the Fed was created, just going back to when we got off the gold standard in 1973, you can see how much our dollar's value has declined. It's horrible, right? This year alone, the dollar has declined somewhere between 7 and 10%, depending on how you calculate it, right? But it's definitely gone down, right? So you see this constantly, this erosion. So to the extent that as much as possible, we want to separate that. Because one of our great advantages, Mike, as you claimed, is we're the world's reserve currency. And I don't think people understand what a powerful economic tool that is, right? And a lot of that comes from the faith the rest of the world has that our Fed is at least somewhat independent of the Oval Office, of Congress, right? Would you agree with that?
Yep. 100%. 100%. It's because of the independence, because the Fed has not been as politicized as other central banks, as other monetary policy authorities around the world, as messed up as ours is. It is much better than the situations created by others around the world. The reason that we want to either end the Fed or at the very least take away the Fed's monetary policy discretion is to make it even less manipulated by humans, even less subject to politicization, right? We're trying to make it a rules-based system so that we don't have a bunch of people who are subject to political pressure or any other kind of pressure in charge of this. We want it to be run by a computer according to a rule. And so what the Trump administration is trying to do is go the opposite direction. They're trying to say, no, we want the Fed to be more political. We, as the elected officials, want to exert greater control over the Fed. And specifically, not because we think we're smarter, they might say it's because they think they're smarter. But specifically, it's not because they think they're smarter. It's because they want more money created. Of course they do. They want more money created. Who cares if there's a lot of inflation a few years from now? We just want to be able to spend a lot of money.
Exactly. And I think that's very key, right? And we'll talk about potential replacements for Powell and all that. But the point to put across is what the administration is trying to accomplish, a key component of this is knocking down interest rates because it lowers what they have to pay on the notes they've issued, right? The U.S. interest obligation would decrease, and you know, again, to your point, the one big beautiful bill passed, which increased the deficit, right? Increased the amount that we owe is going to increase inflation just by its very existence, right? It's like you can't increase things by a couple of trillion, cut $9 billion, and claim victory. It doesn't work that way. So part of this, politically, at least while Trump is still in office, needs to be to knock down interest rates. So that also is political here. So,
yeah, well, that's a really good point. That is all part of it. So what we see are these various attempts by the White House to control the Fed. And before we talk about them individually, let's reinforce any attempt.
Right.
To control the Fed is a bad idea, but I want to go one layer higher in the sense that even the appearance of trying to control the Fed is a bad idea. because these markets are driven by investors who are watching this very, very closely, very sophisticated investors. As you know, anyone who had several billion dollars at stake would be both sophisticated and paying a great deal of attention, right? These people react very, very badly when they think that the system that has made them rich, that has worked very well compared to the rest of the world, that, you know, you and I think that we can make it better, system that has worked very, very well over time, especially in recent decades, the idea that that system should be undermined is a real problem for markets. Nobody wants to see these markets crater because we accidentally made these institutions work worse than they work now. So irrespective of how dumb any one particular idea is, and we'll talk about specific ideas, but irrespective of just how dumb any particular idea is, the real problem is that people are coming up with ideas. The executive branch of the federal government of the United States should not be in the business, by the way, nor should other branches of the federal government, ideas for the Fed. Yeah, that would be along the same lines as me coming up with new surgical ideas for the hospital, you know, 20 miles from my house. You know, I've got a new idea for how to extract your gallbladder, and I'm an economist. I think I know how to do this.
It's not like you came up with the idea and kept it to yourself. You came up with the idea and you're strong-arming the hospital in that case to do the Mike surgery instead of the surgery they've always done.
And I'm biased. I want more gallbladders taken out.
Right. So the conflict of interest is very obvious in my opinion. And to your point, much like...
No one's hiding it. The president is saying he wants lower interest rates.
The thing, right? I think before the show, we were talking about this, just saying, okay, here, how are we going to lay this out? And you had a great point, and I want you to talk about it. There seems to be a convergence now of Republicans or MAGA and Libertarians, where both of us seem to be on the same page at this particular point in time that says,
yep,
hey, let's take a look at this Fed. What's it really doing? Do we really need it? Why?
Yep.
And you would think that both sides would be cheering the fact that two significant ideological movements in this country are at the same point regarding the Fed. But you brought up an interesting point. Talk to me about it.
The problem is, and I blame President Trump himself for this. Normally I blame his staff, and his staff is not helping him, by the way. We will get to those idiots as well. But in this particular case, I got to lay some of the blame on President Trump. By him opening his mouth and complaining, he takes away the credibility of people on his side of the argument to engage in the debate. So it now comes, you're absolutely right, we have all kinds of different people, Republicans who are more traditional, MAGA types, which are not all traditional Republicans, a bunch of Libertarians, a bunch of Independents, all saying we need to look at the Fed and find a better way to do this. That's all good. The problem is that President Trump is coming from the opposite side of the argument. We are trying to say, we want to reform the Fed because we want it less politicized. He's saying we want to reform the Fed because I want it more politicized. Okay, that's a problem because it's unlikely we're going to come up with a solution that satisfies both sides if you want just the Fed to be controlled, you know, by the Treasury Department. We're going to have a problem here because the whole point is to get the button that creates more money away from the White House. We want it farther from the White House, not closer to the White House. I'm trying to take the button away from all the humans, stick it in a computer, lock the computer, and then send it to New York and have the Federal Reserve Bank of New York lock it in their basement where no human being can get to it. And the White House is saying, yeah, we want, this is one of the recent ideas from the White House. And the Treasury Department, even more disturbingly, this is an idea that has been backed, although he has walked it back, he initially supported the idea, the Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, initially supported the idea of having a shadow Federal Reserve Chairman, which is to say they would appoint Jerome Powell's replacement now, but he wouldn't take office until Jerome was done with his tenure, which is up in May. Powell's not going to be done until May. That's, you know, what, 10 months? That's a ways to go, right? 9 or 10 months. So for 9 months or so, you would have some guy or gal as the shadow chair sitting around, I don't know where, presumably in some office in Washington or New York, maybe at the White House. I don't know where this person would be sitting, complaining every day about what it is the Fed is doing. Now, is that person going to be independent of the White House? Of course not. So by the time they take office, by the time Jerome leaves and this person takes over, he or she will be a known Trump acolyte, thereby removing all credibility. The markets would react very badly at the concept. The markets would react badly to everything that they said for those 9 months. And then when they finally took office, the markets would react badly again. This goes into the same category. I just thought of this analogy. You tell me if you like it. This reminds me of Joe Biden saying that he picked Kamala Harris because she's a black female.
Right, that it had to be a black female justice. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, look, I've got no problem, particularly with Brown, who is, you know, an exemplary candidate who has all kinds of qualifications. Now, we can argue about how she, you know, her jurisprudence and how she feels about certain cases, her philosophy. Never mind all that. She's eminently qualified. Okay. So for you to say, I picked her because she's a black female.
Yeah.
Could you do a sister a favor and shut your pie hole?
Right.
Right? Because you just told the whole world, you know, maybe she's smart, maybe she's not. Maybe I like her philosophy, maybe I don't. But what I really like is that she's black female.
A priori is even worse.
Oh, it's a kiss of death.
No, it's an affirmative action hire. It was a hire for a political purpose. So,
and it's not because Republicans asserted it or guessed it or wished it. It's because the White House said
so. For Trump to do that and say, because theoretically, the shadow for Powell is the 12 other guys trying to read, or persons. I don't know if there's any female Fed to.
There's a bunch of females, and good for them because they are smarter.
I'm going to say those guys, all right? But those governors are there.
The other 11, right, the other 11 are the shadow. The committee decides, look, there's 7 people on the Federal Reserve Board, and then there's 5 more that come from the Federal Reserve banks around the region, and those 12 come together and make the committee that decides what the target interest rate's going to be and money supply, yada, yada, yada. Of those 12, they all vote. So as much as you're beating the heck out of the chairman, and the chairman has outsized influence for a variety of reasons, not just, you know, the titular head and being the chairman, which is worth something, but also because he controls all of the staff, controls all the information flow, controls the mechanism, all the levers. So he's got some influence there. But all 12 vote on this. So even if you beat the snot out of the chairman, it's not clear you're going to get your way. All you've really done is embarrass yourself, embarrass the chairman, and embarrass this person who's going to take over. Because imagine, what if you did pick Mr. Wonderful? I don't mean Kevin O'Leary. I mean, what if you did find someone real, Madam Wonderful? You find Madam super smart, super wonderful, and she really is against creating too much inflation. Let's say you found a really good candidate. The White House has no interest in such a person, by the way. But in this alternative universe, it lives only in my mind. Suppose the White House found this terrific person. Nobody would believe it because Trump has already said it has to be someone who will go along with my idea of lowering interest rates.
He said this Trump administration, every person has to take a loyalty pledge.
That is another, I'm glad you brought that up. By the way, I have firsthand experience, not secondhand experience dealing with this.
Yes.
Right? Which is part of the reason why you and I speak every Tuesday rather than me having a job in Washington. Because people ask, you know, can you pledge loyalty to President Trump? And the first word out of my mouth was no. You know, and then I went on with my lecture about you know, I'm not even a Republican. I wasn't at the time. I'm not even a Republican. How could I, you know, I mean, it was just a silly question. But the point is that the administration asked this of all of its employees. So it brings up the question, would the president, by the way, I hope the answer to this is no, but I have no idea. Would the president ask this of appointees to independent agencies like the Fed? I think that that would be illegal, but I also believe it was illegal when the administration was asking of it of employees. I think as a technical matter and an ethical matter and more globally a philosophical matter, you can't have two masters. Either you pledge an oath to the Constitution or you don't. You can't pledge an oath to the Constitution and something else, right? Whether that's President Trump or, you know, Republicans get all concerned about Sharia courts in the United Kingdom. You know, you can't pledge to the crown and to a Sharia court and to the prime minister and to the Constitution. You know, you got to pick a lane. You know, that's what loyalty means. Loyalty, by definition, is picking a lane. You can't say, well, I'm loyal to everybody.
Right. And so to the extent that, A, we want an independent Fed. B, it's particularly touchy with respect specifically to President Trump because he openly says, I want people who will fall on swords for me, jump in front of bullets for me, and all that fun stuff. So he's compounding it. Now, politically, this may play well. Right, because politically, President Trump does a very good job of getting up in front of the cameras and saying, by the way, when you hear people object to this, it's because they're part of the deep state. When you hear people say, you know, like, oh, Jerome Powell's a good guy, he doesn't pay attention to the president, that's a bad thing because, you know,
right.
I need to tell him, I got elected. You guys voted for me. So he's already priming that pump. I saw Justin Amash tweet this earlier this morning. He says the president is already priming on different matters, not just the Fed, by the way. If it didn't come from me, it's not credible, you know, which is disturbing
right.
on a lot of levels. But specifically right. to the Fed, it becomes disturbing because whether it's a shadow chairman, whether it's you influence one of the current governors, whatever, the issue becomes that this becomes a puppeted position of a supposedly independent or largely independent agency. Now, having said that,
if you really cared about how well the Fed as an institution works, you would do everything that you could to maintain its independence because it is its connection to elected officials that undermines its efficacy. And whether that's replacing its discretion with a rule or at the very least, as elected officials, shutting your pie holes so that it could maintain its independence. Indeed, I would suggest, this is not a suggestion for the Trump White House because they would never do anything a libertarian suggested in this context. But I might suggest for, neither would the Biden administration, so some administration in the future, my suggestion might be that the White House defer the selection process to an outside group.
Really?
You see the White House not infrequently lean on outside groups for vetting, for screening, for selecting potential Supreme Court justices, right? We see that all the time. Similarly, we see some deference, not complete deference in either case, but some leaning on outside authorities for the selection of appointments to, for example, the head of the FBI, right? In this day and age, I would go so far as to say one should consider appointing an attorney general from the other party. The days of I can appoint my brother Bobby Kennedy attorney general and people will still trust me are gone. Not everyone trusted John Kennedy in 1961 when he appointed his brother, But to the extent to which anyone would trust such a thing then, those days are gone. And increasingly for cause. Increasingly for cause. There have been political moves resulting from pressure on the Department of Justice. That is absolutely a thing that happens. And our ability to trust the institution has been diminished. Our ability to trust the FBI has been diminished for a variety of reasons, most of which are not very good, but some of them are not very bad.
Yeah.
You know, to preserve these institutions and get them to work as well as they can, they have to work independently.
I agree with you. And like, if I think before we get into the closing part of the show, I just want to say, like, as an example, how many times, if you're just a Joe average citizen right now, do you say, I can't, well, that report coming out of DOJ is BS because we know President Biden's cronies put it together, or we know President Trump's cronies put it together, or how can a president fire somebody who's investigating the presidency, right? Because we saw that. Like, theoretically, a president could say, oh, if this guy's getting too close or this gal's getting too close, I could just fire him or her. That's it. And the next one that comes around better be someone who won't look so closely at what I'm doing. Again, not just President Trump. Any president could do that. So I think people are starting to wake up because I think, Mike, like you said, 20, 30 years ago, the idea of a president firing the person who's investigating him, everybody, it was political suicide. You were better off taking your chances with the result than you were saying, like.
And indeed, it was one of the linchpins in running Nixon out of the city.
Absolutely.
And it should have been.
That's why I'm shocked that Congress doesn't codify this sort of thing, you know, and say if you're under, you know, but
yeah.
That's a different episode. Okay, very quickly now. Let's assume Powell finishes out his term, which I think hopefully Bessent.
I think he will. Courts would have to be involved. Powell understands that if, you know, unless he dies, and maybe even if he does, he needs to stay in power. If it ever crossed his mind to retire early, those ideas have been erased by President Trump wanting him to. He cannot be seen as capitulating to the White House and letting the White House appoint someone to replace him who would have a particular policy stance.
Okay.
So he will stay there. I think it's likely that he'll probably, if I had to guess, be replaced by Kevin Hassett, who is a White House economist, very senior guy, smart guy, good guy. But Kevin's got two problems. And this isn't personal, right? He's a good guy. He means well, smart guy. He's got two big problems. One is he's already shot his mouth off about wanting lower interest rates. Okay. You cannot, you know, this is why Supreme Court justices don't answer questions about how they would rule on specific cases when they're giving their testimony before congressional hearings, right? You can't shoot your mouth off because that means that there's a possibility that you're being appointed because of how you would rule in certain cases. Well, of course, in this particular case, that's exactly why he's shooting his mouth off. So that President Trump will like him.
By the way, for those that aren't aware, Hassett was formerly the president's the chairman of economic advisors, right? So,
and now the National Economic Council, right? So, okay, very good guy, you know, been around the block. He has sufficient credentials, but the other problem is that even if he had kept his mouth shut, anybody who has been appointed by the president, by the current president, any current president, should automatically be disqualified. And this should take Scott Bessent out of it as well. If you've been appointed, I don't mean to the Fed, but if you've been appointed to some other job, if you're a Trump guy, if you're a Trump gal, you have to be automatically disqualified. These people need to be independent. And that institution is not independent if you've appointed, you know, your brother-in-law to one spot, right? And your personal accountants and your personal attorneys to two more, you know, and your grandson is taking the fourth slot. That's not an independent agency, right? And then you say, then you want to pretend like this is all at arm's length. That's not how this works. You need to be appointing people who have not expressed an opinion and about whom you yourself have not expressed an opinion.
I agree, and that would seem to me the reason why you shouldn't, whether you do or not, consider like Bessent. Like, if someone were to say, we want Bessent to move from Treasury to the Fed, to head the Fed in 2026.
Can't do it.
You shouldn't be able to do it.
You shouldn't be able to do it.
That's why it's troubling. If you had your druthers, Mike, is there someone you would like to see replace Powell when his term is up? Let's end it on that.
I think there are two answers to that. One is the more likely guy is a guy by the name of Kevin Warsh, who used to be sort of a wunderkind, who was on the Federal Reserve Board from, you know, he was a W appointee. So, you know, 2005 or something to like 2010, something like this for several years. Conservative, anti-inflation, believes the Fed needs to be independent. He has said things recently about Treasury-Fed coordination, which is something he should not have said. He meant well. He has always talked about the Fed maintaining independence. What he meant was the Treasury Department needs to do a good job of communicating when it's going to be issuing debt, so that if the Fed is going to do any purchases, they can coordinate that with their own monetary supply. It's a logical, technocratic thing to say. It's just not something that should be said out loud if you're wanting to be considered.
Well, it can also be misconstrued.
It can be misconstrued. That's the big reason. Not because what he said was per se dumb. It was probably a good idea. It's a technical matter. But he shouldn't have been bringing up, you know, the word coordination in the same sentence with the word Treasury and the word Fed. Those are three words that just shouldn't be in the same sentence, because people will misperceive it. And, you know, Trump has spoken highly of him. So he's the one guy who would fight for independence that President Trump, you know, has made good moves toward, right? So that I think is reasonable. But my number one choice would be to throw a dart at a dartboard and, you know, load the dartboard with people who are qualified that you don't know, and screen them out for dumb things. Don't screen them in for smart things. Screen out people who have said dumb things about undermining the Fed's independence. Screen out people who have said, in a long-term sense, that we need more inflation. People who have said nice things about modern monetary policy. Right. You know, there are a lot of dumb things that people say. You can screen out for all of those. If you're going to screen in for something, I would screen in for traditional training or Fed experience. I don't think that as a philosophical matter, those things necessarily should be requirements, but you've got to know how the system works. Right. Don't put someone at the top of the system who doesn't know how the system works. I don't trust this idea of, to bring down an institution, you need to bring people in who don't understand it.
Right.
You can bring people in who hate it. Right? You don't bring people in who don't understand it. That's how Doge got into trouble. And Doge did a lot of good, but it was really inefficient and ended up not as successful as it could have been. So I would screen in, you know, people who understand the system and who are qualified. Screen out people who have said dumb things, and screen out anyone with a relationship with Trump or the administration or anything like that, and then throw a dart at them. That's, I think, the best way to do it. You need some independence.
I certainly agree with you on that, and I don't have much hope that that'll happen, Mike, or anything.
No, zero. That's why the best hope that we got is Kevin Warsh.
Just looking at my notes, you said he was a wunderkind. Just to reinforce that, he's the youngest ever governor, federal. He at 35. Yeah,
is that right?
35 when he was appointed by President Bush.
35 is too young. I'm here to tell you, as someone who was 35 a long time ago, that's probably too young. But you know, everyone says he's a smart guy. He's conservative. He's fine, and he would be fine. That was a long time ago. That means he's in his mid-50s now. And he's got solid academic credentials. He understands how the system works. If he wants to change the system, and I hope he does, I'd be right there doing everything I personally could to help with that.
All right, Mike, this has been a great nerd hour. I loved it. I wish we could talk some more and get into different layers, but not for today. Everyone out there, you've been watching Liberty Lens right here on Grumblings Media. Check us out, grumblingsmedia.com. All your favorite platforms, whether it's YouTube, Rumble, Facebook, you can find us on Amazon Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, basically anywhere podcasts and shows are, you'll find us. Until next week when we have the next episode of Liberty Lens, this has been Big John from Mike Kamat. Peace, everyone.